Good afternoon, everybody. East Africa there, my definition is somewhat more broad than Neil. Basically, wherever the Indian Ocean will be, I consider in this part there to be East Africa, rather than just confined there to the Kenya-Tanzania shoreline. And we will see here further, our focus is very much more to the south. When I gained permission there to give this talk, I was asked there to put in this slide on forward-looking statements, which I hope you can read well. And also there, I was asked there just to give you a little bit of background on Sasol, there being basically a large integrated chemical group there. Most of our facilities there are in South Africa, which is our base, but also there we have expansions into the US and Europe. World leader in gas-to-liquids technology with 60 years' experience there from our various plants and ability to fund growth. Looking at the balanced portfolio and the E&PI part, this part of the whole is quite small, but a significant thing for the company. The one slide I was asked to give morphed into two, just to show you where we are, spread quite a way around the planet. And unfortunately, because of the expansion of the Europe here, I wasn't able to actually restore this map back to the Jurassic that I was hoping to do so, but maybe we'll have a go at that later. And just looking at the operations where we are based, primarily down in Mozambique, where... primarily down in Mozambique, where we hold significant acreage, both production and exploration, but also there further down in ER236 off South Africa there, to the south of Mozambique, TCP 3A4A in the Orange Basin, and then up in Ntam in Gabon. So my talk really here is going on work I've been undertaking on plate modelling and paleogeography, fundamental really to understand the petroleum systems of our areas, is to understand the paleogeography, and you cannot get a handle on the paleogeography if you don't have a handle on the plate tectonics. So the whole lot is really kind of quite fundamental, and I've given here examples there from both CGG and GTEC there as plugs. Part of my job there was to actually look and see at what levels we were going to look at different plate tectonics. Coming up in, I think it's October, is it? Yes, it is in October. There's a conference here at the JOLSOC on plate tectonics, and entitled there, Plate Tectonics at 50, it proudly proclaims. And I suppose that really comes back because Tuzo Wilson kind of put out his tentative papers there, looking there at the opening of the North Atlantic in his Nature paper here of 1966. But as a Southern African geologist, I feel this is somewhat disingenuous, and that the story of plate tectonics and its understanding goes back a little bit before 50 years. And I have to introduce you to some of my Southern African geo heroes who first recognized plate tectonics for what it was and also had the boldness to publish it, even though they were somewhat poo-pooed at the time. Alex de Toy was a fantastic field geologist. And basically, he recognized there the union of South America and Africa from first geological principles by looking at the rocks, both in Africa and in South America, and comparing that to scientific reports that were available for India and Australia. But he wasn't the first, because Alex was building upon the work of yet another superb scientist, Alfred Wegener, a German, died far too young doing what he loved on an expedition to Greenland. And back in 1912, he first published his work on the origin of the continents, where he discussed buoyancy, he discussed the patterns of the coastlines and suggested that the continents were once more originally there together. But he was largely ignored because Herr Wegener was not a geologist. He was a meteorologist and a geographer. But of course, both these gentlemen there had very little recognition at the time, because, of course, the august scientists of the world, many of whom spoke in what was the previous lecture theatre in this establishment, says, but what on earth could actually power such a system that could move continents apart? And, of course, it took such great scientific understanding as Arthur Holmes from Durham, who finally kind of put his finger on what was driving all this, the nuclear reactions and nuclear decay occurring within the mantle, driving convection systems at a scale sufficient to move the Earth. But looking at plate tectonics, the insight I think it gains often there is by looking at the big picture. And for this there, the free air gravity of Africa basically paints the canvas on which I want to look at on this bit of a talk this early afternoon, effectively looking at the margin of Africa that became the Indian Ocean. And it's on this gravity, this fundamental data, that we can see that most fundamental of structure within the plate tectonic domain, the continent-ocean boundary. At the end of the day, this is what drives our reconstructions, is recognizing that. And important there for us in recognizing the paleogeography of East Africa was understanding where that continent-ocean boundary was around the coast of Africa. And it's quite prominent, as you can see here on the west coast, very prominent here on the Falkland-Agulhas fracture zone. But when you trace it up, you just have to follow your eye along the Lebombo and up the Sabi monocline and across there to the present coastline there of central Mozambique. I draw your attention to some paleobathymetry out of Antarctica that was published by the Alfred Wegener Institute at Bremerhaven. And that bathymetry is quite illustrative, because it was on one of those 1970s expeditions there on the research vessel Explorer that the Explorer escarpment and wedge were discovered. We subsequently know there that it's almost a type locality for seaward dipping reflectors here on the Explorer wedge. And the Explorer escarpment, this long linear feature here, a 2,000-metre subsea cliff. And when you look at the angle that these the wedge and the escarpment subtend, it fits perfectly the notch within Africa against the Lebombo and Sabi monoclines. So, of course, this basically defines the tight fit of Antarctica and Africa. And it's quite fundamental, because at the end of the day, it determines what is the nature of the crust in southern Mozambique. In looking at various software that I was tasked to do this past period there, I was looking at various commercial and also just off-the-shelf software, and I have to say there that I came across G-plates produced by the University of Sydney. And for those of you that haven't actually seen it and played with it, I strongly recommend it to you. It's free, it's academic, and it's extremely powerful. And I use this by way of illustration there, using their tutorial 3.2, I think Meta there was asking, would generate these images for you and your management presentations. But we can see here, and this is using the published model there of Seaton et al. In 2012 in the Earth Science Review paper, and basically follows the tight fit model of Africa and Antarctica back into the Jurassic at 170 with a tight fit in here. And here at 155, we see the southern Mozambique ocean opening along there with the Somali ocean. And you can see this developing through time. Is the Seaton model absolutely correct? I think it's not quite there, but it's pretty well close. Who has got it pretty well close, I think, is Colin Reeves out of Holland there. This is a subsection of some of his illustrations. And you can see here there the to-ing and fro-ing there, and fitting in this corner of Antarctica, tight in there to Africa, and the subsequent development there of both the Somali and the Mozambique oceans. His interpretation of Limpopo here, I'm not too convinced about. I feel as though that is visible there already within the bathymetry of current-day Antarctica. But nonetheless, I think it gives a very good starting block for looking at the very complex spreading history within the Indian Ocean. So with that in mind, you develop, and in fact, it was a paper that I first came across there, I've been looking at the fit of Antarctica and Africa there since I was first a postgraduate student at Wits University back in the early 80s, when it was still very much a loose fit, having arguments there with Martin de Witt and his colleagues there, putting together the 1983 APG, I think it was, map of Gondwanaland. But here from the Geological Survey of Finland, a special publication, was the first one that I saw a really nice fit of Antarctica there, well within to the southern Mozambique basin. And so it infers really some very fundamental concepts. It's oceanic crust. By that, there is no Karoo. And what we see today in southern Mozambique is a post-drift delta. And that delta has its origins in the Paleo Limpopo. If we look at deltas on oceanic crust around Africa today, there are three good examples. One is quite well known out in Nigeria, the Niger Delta on the edge of the Transform margin there in the Bight of Biafra. A very thick sequence built out onto oceanic crust. There's the Nile. And all these maps, by the way, are the same scale, out of Ed Purdy's work there, produced as a GSL special publication back in 2003. And at that same scale, here is the Limpopo Delta, and with the Limpopo River entering in through the failed triple arm of the breakup at that point. And so effectively what we have is a build-up of various prograding and transgressing deltaic sediments on top of younging oceanic crust. Younging because the rifting starts against this margin and progresses in a southward direction as Antarctica tears away. So let's do a little bit of in detail look at some paleo modelling here through time. And we'll skip to about 150, and this again is using G plates. And I've taken the opportunity here in a kind of antithesis of Slaty Barkfast and his second manufacturing of Africa, where I've taken Antarctica and applied a more of an equatorial, tropical view to it, as its somewhat current ice-covered nature there draws the eye away from the paleogeography at the time. But at 150, we have a tight, we know we have rifting occurring there up from Madagascar from the Kenyan coast, and I believe that that's not quite tight enough in my mind, but that's the model that Seton there have published. And at the same time, we have the incipient rifting occurring here between Antarctica and Africa, and a transform margin forming down here against the South African coast and drawing Maudland here in Antarctica. We know we've got known Jurassic source rocks up in East Africa, up in Madagascar, and we know we've got the Jurassic source rocks there that have been drilled in DSDP 330 on the Morris Ewing Bank, currently offshore of the Falkland Islands, when you fit all this back together again. And if we were to zoom in, and I'm sorry there for the lack of resolution when you start blowing up these rest images, but effectively what we have there is we have our Jurassic source rocks forming in this early rift here off the African shores. And I wanted to point out here that we have the then mid-ocean ridge between Antarctica and Africa, and so that The Jurassic source rock that we see here along the coast of Mozambique, that the source rock here of Jurassic is of course no longer there. It's firmly attached to the coast of Antarctica. So keep in mind here that we're dealing with half Graben's are sexually preserved. Our current Panitumani fields are here in southern Mozambique. And of course the black dotted line here is the current outline of the southern Mozambique basin, the current coastline as such, the southern Mozambique basin. At the time, the drainage there in southern Africa was into its internal drainage with various alkaline lakes. There are reports there of late Jurassic sauropod trails there in northern Zimbabwe, dated, these are in sediments that post-date the Stormberg volcanics. So we have internal drainage going on at that time. Ironically, the dinosaur footprints that were discovered in about 2000 here in northern Zimbabwe were destroyed 10 years later by elephants. So they're successors. But when we move into the Jurassic Cretaceous boundary, we now start to see a major player occurring in the game, and this is the Paleo Limpopo. The Limpopo River currently drains an area of Africa round about so. But in the Cretaceous, we know from various studies that have been undertaken, looking at the earlier sources of this, that the drainage of the Limpopo was probably from within the Congo Basin itself. It's uncertain how far into the Congo Basin, but it could have well have been significantly of the Congo Basin, because it was certainly not draining to the west. We have South America firmly docked in at that point. So the Paleo Limpopo was a mighty river drawing its supply from the whole of Central Africa and draining out through the failed arm of the breakout of Antarctica, and we start to see the development of the Paleo Limpopo Delta. If you remark on how large this delta is, especially when you compare it there to the Nile and to the Niger, just think of the size of river that the Paleo Limpopo represented. It's larger than the Niger River that one sees today. So it's a huge catchment. We see this developing delta. And also, in what is still very much a restricted basin at this time, well, obviously we're open to Tethys at the north. We're less certain to how we're open to the rest of the Pamphylacian Ocean there to the south. But effectively, at the Cretaceous boundary, we are basically still very much there, a bounded basin with potential there, not only for Jurassic source rock in a restricted manner, but also there for possibly earliest Cretaceous restricted marine conditions that are present within this part of the basin. And also remember that south of the Paleo mid-oceanic ridge, this potential source rock is now in the Antarctic domain. When we move into towards the middle Cretaceous, we see now that Antarctica has drifted well away. Likewise there, Madagascar. And we've got more open marine conditions. It's likely now that we're seeing within the Mozambique Basin ocean circulating conditions. It's possibly less likely there that we're going to have these restricted marines for with their associated source rock. And so this particular stage, we're probably dealing with more with open marine conditions. And again, our Paleo Limpopo is still tapping this large headwater within Africa. And at this point, of course, we now start to have the pulling away of South America. We see the incipient rifting that occurs here down within the Otaniqua Basin that we heard about earlier, up into West Africa. But again, at this stage, the footwall uplift associated with that rifting in West Africa largely precluded the Congo River from doing its job, so that the drainage was still to the south, again, adding more and more sediment there to our delta that we see down here in the south. This is the work there of Haddon and Spike McCarthy out of Wits University, looking there at the Paleo Limpopo, and this is their work here. And then a sudden event occurs there in the latest Cretaceous. The mechanism for it is still poorly understood. Some say that it's an earliest manifestation there of East African rift tectonics. But it's rather dramatic because there is uplift on the Zimbabwe Kalahari Rise, as it is called. This is the present-day the Okavango. And effectively, it beheads the Limpopo River. And this is quite significant because it cuts off the sediment supply to the Paleo-Limpopo Delta, and also there creates a ponded inland drainage system that we see in Africa. The Kalahari sands, which are late Cretaceous to early tertiary sands that cover a huge area of internal southern Africa, are entirely the process of the internal drainage of the beheaded Limpopo. Meanwhile, the delta dies, and this is when we start seeing the Chirangoma limestones and the occurring within the southern Mozambique basin. There's a hiatus there in drainage. But later on, we see an interloper, the Zambezi. I call it the Lake Pretender. It starts to basically cut its headwaters up, successively taking over what used to drain into the Limpopo, now drains into the Zambezi. And it was quite late on, as late as probably the Pliocene, where it finally, the Zambezi tapped into the headwaters of the Paleo-Limpopo at and about Victoria Falls. But it's from the Miocene there, we're seeing there that the sediment supply switches from what is a very runt of a Limpopo that the present day into what is the big African river on this coastline, which is the Zambezi. And what we see today is a product, again, of very late uplift, Pliocene uplift, possibly associated there with magmatic plumes. Again, there we have a late uplift that we can see and date there on the coast of southern Africa. It's the date there of the Great Escarpment that we see here in the Drakensberg. But effectively, what we're seeing today and what hides its true nature is that Pliocene uplift has uplifted the drowned delta of the Paleo-Limpopo above sea level, such that the present Limpopo River and Savi River are effectively cutting down through the older sediments deposited, such that we have a Cretaceous sections exposed here in the upper part of the southern Mozambique basin, and effectively they are frozen into their position. They can no longer migrate across in a deltaic fashion that they would have done at the time that the delta was active. And until base level can cut its way back in again, will not do so. And so I think this is why this is not recognised for what it is there, as an old and Cretaceous age deltaic system. So put it to you there that the present day Limpopo is but a small manifestation of the older Limpopo. And to paraphrase the words of Rudyard Kipling, I put it to you that the Cretaceous Limpopo was not only greater, it was not only grey-greener, but it might even have been greasier. So what is the plate modelling telling us here in the East African hydrocarbon provinces on this particular area? And obviously we focus very much in Mozambique, but it's applicable just as much there to the north, is that it infers there the presence of oceanic crust, basically between southern Mozambique basin. It precludes the presence of Karoo lithologies. So when you're looking at source rocks, when we're looking at what is our source in these areas, we cannot look to Karoo. If you wish the Karoo, you have to look beneath the ice of Antarctica, where gravity is showing you the extensions of the lower Zambezi graben to this day. The form that we see here in southern Mozambique, that basin, is the Paleo-Limpopo Delta, and it formed entirely post-rift. There's a Jurassic source play in southern Mozambique, and all the implications that a Jurassic-restricted marine, or even, in its earliest days, lacustrine source rock, could infer. And that those restricted marine conditions occurred up to the very earliest of Cretaceous, at least, and so we could be looking at sources of that age in this area also to this day. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much.
Oh, that was a great tour around all of East African plates, I think. Do we have any questions?
Yeah, I've got a question again. again for our East African Oil Group. Excuse my voice. We reckoned there would be lower middle Jurassic source rocks through that area, but we were very concerned about the levels of maturity since it's underneath a sort of plume head, and we felt this stuff would probably be overcooked. Have you done any modelling on the Jurassic?
We have, but I'm not the geochemist, so I can't really comment on any of the modelling there. But really, what you must look at there, obviously, where it's been buried there by these huge sediment thicknesses that you see, then yes, I can see that you're going to be burnt out. But where there's less sediment overburden, it's not necessarily so. And remember there that it's on oceanic crust, and so therefore your heat flow levels are considerably less. And so therefore there, things can balance out.
Yeah. Cool. Oh, sorry. Yeah, Duncan McGregor again. I really struggle with the significance that you're putting on a Paleolimpopo, simply because I've done some calculations myself in African river systems, and I cannot get a significant volume or sedimentary rate out of your Paleolimpopo. Nothing like the Zambezi, certainly nothing like the Niger or the Nile. You know, we're dealing with order of magnitude differences there. So can you help me? If it's such a big river as that, where are the substantial? Multi-kilometre sedimentary piles? Because this is not that thick a section.
Basically, I think we can say we've got just looking at the wells that are in the public domain, we've got between 4 and 5 kilometres of sediment thickness in the Limpopo. We look at the area of that, and then we look at the area there of the catchment of the Paleolimpopo, and it's one really there, I think, of just doing a simple division of sediment supply to sediment deposition. Here we've got a concentration there with 4 to 5 kilometres, and here we've got a huge area. And just looking at a back of an envelope there, I would guess that it's probably a kilometre to 500 metres of denudation. And I think we can see that there, that those levels of uplift there from apatite fishing work would suggest that we've got that levels of uplift within Central Africa.
I agree with you on the uplift, but I mean the volumes, I just...
If it's uplifted, it had to erode. And so if it's uplifted and eroded, that sediment had to go somewhere. And I would contend that it's sitting right here in southern Mozambique.
I just rather doubt it's going to balance, but I have to go back and check. Yeah.
That's lovely. Well, thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.